Live from KCUR News, this is Casey Currents on Central Standard, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. In the shadow of the government shutdown, Congress also let the Farm Bill expire this week. Today on Casey Currents, we check in on where Congress is at with the Farm Bill and what it means for local farmers. And we'll look at the debate over food stamps, which are a major part of the bill. Just this week, some 20,000 Kansans lost eligibility for food stamps.
We don't want to encourage dependency. This is a hand out, reaching out to help people up out of poverty through employment.
And in our What Is That series, we meet a South Kansas City woman who builds homes for her animals. It's Casey Currents. Listen up just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Welcome to Casey Currents. We use stories and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. And now we're live, so we can take your calls on some of the big issues in our community. All the talk in Washington this week was about Obamacare, the government shutdown, and the upcoming debt ceiling debate. But in the background of all of that, Congress quietly let the Farm Bill expire. It was due for renewal at the end of last year and extended until Monday, September 30th. So here we are in October with no Farm Bill and some serious divisions about major aspects of the legislation. To understand the impact of the Farm Bill, or the lack thereof, on farmers, the hungry, and everyone else, we turn to our friends at Harvest Public Media. Reporter Jeremy Bernfeld is here in the studio. Thank you for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, Sylvia.
So what exactly is in the Farm Bill?
Well, you know, the Farm Bill, it's a massive bill. It contains about almost $1 trillion in spending.
Wow.
What we refer to as the Farm Bill is really a package of legislation that, on one hand, charts farm policy for farmers. We're talking about crop insurance. We're talking about disaster aid programs. We're talking about research, things that really apply to people out there in the fields. On the other hand, we're talking about food assistance, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which often people refer to it as SNAP, but we also call it food stamps, of course. That makes up about 80% of the bill. So it also contains all that nutrition funding.
80%. So it's a huge part of the bill.
It's $80 billion annually or thereabouts.
What are the other big parts of the bill sort of financially besides that, the food stamps?
Well, I think, again, food stamps make up about 80% of the bill. So we're already just talking about 20 to 25%. But there are huge farm programs involved. I mean, crop insurance is a big program. In the current Farm Bill, there's a program called direct payments that is basically another kind of farm subsidy. Those are big programs that farmers have been depending on for years.
And I know at Harvest you've been doing a lot of reporting on crop insurance. How exactly does it work? The federal government basically insures farmers if their crops don't work out some years?
It can be a kind of complicated process, but basically what it is there's a group of private insurance companies that run the crop insurance program, but it's heavily subsidized by the federal government, both to those companies that provide the insurance as well as to the premiums that farmers pay.
So is there anything that just stopped on October 1st when the bill expired?
You know, the October 1st expiration date doesn't mean all that much. And I think that's one reason why, as you said, it was kind of quietly let go. There are a bunch of programs. So most of the programs continue through the crop year. So crops that are already in the ground or crops that are about to go in the ground will continue. So come spring planting time, then we'll be talking about a different group of effects. So a lot of it will extend through that. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, those food stamps program, that's authorized through some stimulus spending from 2009 to go for another 6 months to a year, so that's going to continue. The big issue is come January 1st, we're going to revert to the farm policy that's already on the books. And that farm policy was actually created in 1949. So a very different United States, a very different food system at that point. And since then, we've just been kind of updating it with these farm bills every 5 years. So that's going to kick in, and that's going to cause a bunch of different things to happen, including very likely that milk prices, dairy prices would double. So that's going to be when you're going to first start to see the effect as far as the farm part goes.
And people were worried about that last year and calling it the dairy cliff. But why exactly were milk prices double?
Well, really, it's that 1949 law that guarantees a price for dairy farmers. There were different goals in farm policy in 1949. It was a very different United States and, as I said, a very different food system. So that law would basically kick in and it would ensure that dairy farmers get a price that's at about double what they're getting right now.
Huh. Now, what are the major points of contention in the farm bill?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of agreement, actually, on the farm part of the farm bill. The major disagreements are really coming in the SNAP benefits, in the food stamps. The Senate passed its version of the farm bill in June, and in it, there were cuts to the food stamp program. There were about $400 million annually. So that's $4 billion over 10 years. Again, we're talking about an $80 billion program. Hmm. The House side, the part of the farm bill that deals with the nutrition policy from the House that they passed, that cuts $4 billion annually. So 10 times what the Senate cut. That's where the big disagreement is.
And what would be and then there was the idea of actually just separating SNAP from the farm bill altogether. Was that in the House bill?
Yeah, that's right. The House ended up so historically, there's been this kind of coalition of putting the farm programs together with the nutrition programs. And the reason that existed was to basically to get support from urban areas and legislators from urban areas for farm programs. So there's been this historic coalition that's ever since Bob Dole got it rolling decades ago. And so the House basically split that. There, as I said, there's large agreement over the farm issue, so that kind of passed easily. And they're trying to really take aim at the House Republicans generally are trying to take aim at the nutrition program. So they split it. That's probably not going to be the end result. There's kind of been a wide outcry that those two areas were split and that this historical coalition was broken.
So if most programs didn't just stop when the bill expired, how does the lack of a farm bill make a difference to farmers?
Well, you know, farmers are always thinking 6 months to a year ahead. I mean, this is a business that relies on planning, and they cannot plan. I mean, from a farmer's perspective, they're making decisions right now. They're going to make or break their business, and they don't know how the federal government is going to help or hurt their business come 6 months to a year. So that's a big issue. They're making planting decisions. They're making decisions on what materials to buy and how they're going to run their farm. So that's a big issue. Also, all this uncertainty, as you said, the farm bill initially expired last year at this time. And in that run up to the dairy cliff, they kind of passed an extension of most of the programs. But that already cut out a lot of different programs, including assistance for beginning farmers and ranchers, including assistance to organic farmers, things like that. So those programs are in flux, and they, in fact, they haven't been funded for the last 9 months. So now folks who are interested in those programs are having difficulty getting into the business.
And are there particular areas of concern for farmers in our region?
Well, I think, again, there's wide agreement on crop insurance, and that's very important to farmers in the Midwest. But I think farmers really need to see what the policy is going to look like in specifics if they're going to make those planning decisions for planting. And as I said, the dairy farmers, they've lost their livestock assistance. So were there to be, you know, another widespread drought or an issue like that, they wouldn't be able to apply for livestock assistance because there's no farm bill. So they're watching that pretty closely.
Do you have a sense of what farmers feel about SNAP benefits being part of the farm bill? And just from people you've talked to and that other reporters at Harvest have talked to?
You know, I think it does keep changing. I think in general, most farmers that we talk to kind of appreciate, as I said, that coalition that really makes people care more about the farm part of the farm bill. But as it continues to delay the farm issues, I think farmers are certainly getting frustrated. And I think some are questioning, well, you know, if we've got agreement on the farm programs that matter to me, can we just get that through?
And what about our local legislators in Missouri and Kansas? What are they responding to farmers? I mean, it's a pretty serious lobby, a pretty serious voting block in Missouri and Kansas.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think you see press conferences, tweets, emails, all of those things almost daily from many of the legislators in Kansas and Missouri talking about the farm bill and the lack thereof. I think, as you said, it's been overshadowed by the big issues in Congress right now, you know, between the shutdown, the debt ceiling, Obamacare, immigration, those kinds of things. So, you know, without a big issues stemming from the expiration on October 1st, I think it has been a little bit on the back burner, even if there is some political wrangling going on.
So, Jeremy, you follow this pretty closely. What does your crystal ball say about what's going to happen?
Well, I think this dairy cliff and the reversion to the 1949 law on January 1st would be a huge, huge mistake and a big issue. So I can't imagine that they're going to let it go further than that. I mean, we've had Senate negotiators say that they're not interested in another extension. But honestly, if I had to make a guess, I would say that there would be another extension past New Year's Eve, just like last year.
And no kind of final version of the farm bill then.
I would imagine the uncertainty will continue.
And what are they going to go into a conference committee then?
Yeah, the Senate. So what has to happen is the Senate and the House go to a conference committee to merge the differences between the bills that they've passed, because both chambers have passed a bill. Now, the Senate has appointed its conferees, the people who are going to be charged with negotiating with the House. The House has yet to do that. And again, in large part because John Boehner is the one who has to make those appointments. And John Boehner's been a little busy recently.
And you've been following this on your website there at harvestpublicmedia.org. People want a lot more about the farm bill and what's going on and how it's impacting local farmers. They can go there. Jeremy Bernfeld, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, Sylvia.
Jeremy Bernfeld is a reporter for Harvest Public Media, an agricultural reporting service based here at KCUR. And now we're going to get into some major changes in how the state of Kansas administers the SNAP program. This week, new food stamp eligibility requirements went into effect for unemployed people in Kansas. Now, any healthy Kansans between 18 and 49, if they don't have any kids or other dependents, have to work or be in a job training program to earn SNAP benefits. If you're being cut from Kansas's food stamp program, or if you have an opinion about it, we'd like to hear from you. Call 816-235-2888 or comment on KCUR's Facebook page. But first, Casey Current's Laura Ziegler reports that advocates for the poor say that these cuts will create a dangerous hole in an already thin safety net.
Kalima Brown navigates her stroller through the aisles of a Kansas City, Kansas discount grocery store looking for the special infant formula she needs for her two-month-old baby. It's expensive. And she says each month, nearly half her $314 in food stamps goes for baby food.
I probably have to buy it probably about every 15 days. And that's basically when I buy it with my food stamps. I would probably buy about 5 cans, which come up to about $142.
And that leaves Brown with about $172 a month to feed her and her unemployed fiancé. Brown won't lose her food stamps under the new law because those with children are still eligible. But an estimated 20,000 Kansans without children now have the next 90 days to either get a job or enroll in job training if they want to keep their food stamps. As she searches for the plumpest package of frozen chicken, Kalima Brown says she doesn't have a problem with these tougher requirements.
And I was raised with my brother who fed us all with cash. He worked, and I agree. I think they should have a time frame on having food stamps, a limited, because it makes people lazy when you just give in and give in. They don't want to do anything.
Advocates for the poor see it differently. They say there will be several adverse ripple effects as the result of these changes. Kansas City area food banks, for example, say they could see double the number of people at feeding sites and food distribution centers, an unsustainable increase at a time providers say they're already stretched to the limit. I met economist Dr. Linwood Tauheed, an expert on community development, at a coffee shop to talk about the food stamp debate and the changes states like Kansas are making. He says cuts can have a negative impact on the economy because the money people spend at the grocery store ripples out into coffee houses like this one, department stores, electronics stores, even the real estate market.
Food stamp programs are what are called counter-cyclical. When the economy is worse, those programs expand. which actually helps to stimulate the economy. It puts money into the economy that would not normally be there because people aren't working and so they don't have income.
In fact, an analysis by Moody's Analytics says every dollar spent on food has a multiplier effect, putting roughly 75 cents back into the economy. Even though Kansas has relatively low unemployment at 5.5%, the Kansas Department of Labor reports available jobs are mostly in low-paying, unskilled positions. In these still shaky economic times, Professor Tauhid says job training won't help.
And so spending money for food stamps is much smarter than spending money for jobs that don't exist.
I personally see jobs available signs almost every day somewhere, and so the economy is very able to support that.
Phyllis Gilmore is chairman of the Kansas Department of Children and Families, and she disagrees. She says the move in Kansas amounts to an act of tough love.
I strongly believe that people can take care of themselves. I have confidence in the human spirit and that people are able and that we don't want to encourage dependency. This is a hand out, reaching out to help people up out of poverty through employment.
With 14% of Kansans living below the poverty level, that's $22,000 a year for a family of four, critics of cuts to food stamps say this is patronizing and unrealistic. Eight other states either have or are in the process of requiring able-bodied single people to work for food stamps. As the disagreement in Washington about how much to fund food stamps holds up the farm bill, these states are moving forward on their own to deal with the issue. For Casey Currents, I'm Laura Ziegler.
Just after the break, we'll be opening up the phone lines to answer your questions and take your comments about food stamps in Kansas and nationwide. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or comment on KCUR's Facebook page. This is Casey Currents. Welcome back to Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. As we just heard in Laura Ziegler's piece, Kansas's new rules for food stamp recipients require them to work if they are able-bodied and have no dependents. They're actually federal requirements that were in effect until 2009, but were waived across the country when the recession hit. Kansas is one of a handful of states that are voluntarily reinstating those rules. But if Congress makes major cuts to the SNAP program, Kansas's culling of the food stamp rules could be a preview of what's to come for the rest of the country. Do you think people should be required to work to receive food stamps? Kansas City, call us with your thoughts and questions at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Now, to help us understand the potential impact of cutting people from food stamps, we have with us today Ellen Feldhausen of Harvesters, the Community Food Network in Kansas City. Welcome.
Good morning.
And Rachel Sheffield, the policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also James Ziliak, economics professor at the University of Kentucky and director for the Center of Poverty Research. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Let's start with you, Professor James Ziliak. Can you explain why food stamps have historically been part of the Farm Bill? We just heard Jeremy Bernfeld talking about that a little bit, about that coalition of urban and rural legislators.
Yeah, that's certainly the origins of it. I mean, the initial food stamp program was more of a commodity distribution program starting in the 1930s and carried on through World War II. And then when President Kennedy was elected in 1960, in response to his exposure to widespread poverty, especially in the state of West Virginia, he started a movement to establish a food stamp program. And I think there, you know, in part to try to get support in the Senate, he included it or proposed that, you know, it be included as part of the Ag Department because the original authoring legislation of the bill makes very explicit that it's not only to address hunger and malnutrition in the United States, but also to strengthen the nation's agricultural economy. So it's very, very much part of the initial legislation.
Just moving ahead in time, how long has there been this work requirement on SNAP that was waived in 2009?
1996. It was part of the 1996 welfare reform bill that added this new dimension that if you are an able-bodied adult without a dependent between the ages of 18 and 50, that you could qualify for food stamps only 3 months out of every 36-month period unless you're working at least 20 hours per week or engage in other type of activity at a level commensurate with working like 20 hours per week or more. And so, in effect, if you are just a part-time worker working, you know, less than 20 hours a week without dependents and without a documented disability, then you can only get food stamps a few months out of every few years.
Hmm. And what happened when that was requirement was instituted?
Well, what you would see is there was an increase in the share of the case that was comprised of adults with children in the household, as well as a slight uptick in the fraction of the caseload that were seniors. It's also the case, you know, when that legislation went into place, that the economy was very strong, right? So we had a very strong economy from 96 to 2000. And so some of these individuals may have been able to find work quite readily at that time. It's important to know, though, that states were given the option to apply for a waiver since 1996 from that provision if they had very high rates of unemployment in their local area, rates that exceeded the national rate and were also persistently high for some documented period of time. And so states did periodically, you know, request waivers from USDA from that rule, especially during the 2001 recession.
And what happened when it was waived in 2009 during that recession? I understand that food stamp usage skyrocketed.
Yeah, food stamp usage actually has skyrocketed. It started its upward trend around 2001 during the recession, and it's increased about 170% since 2000, and it continued to increase and accelerated after the Great Recession. And so because jobs were scarce for people of all walks of life, including those able-bodied adults without dependents, their numbers on the caseload increased commensurate as well.
And I want to bring in our other guest, Rachel Sheffield of the Heritage Foundation. How do you see what happened with food stamps when the recession hit, that most recent recession in 2009?
Well, we certainly saw an increase in participation, and that can certainly be attributed to the recession in part. However, we have seen policy changes put into place over the years that have made it easier for people to get onto the food stamp rolls. So there's two different factors working here in this increase that we've seen in
what
over the years.
What policy changes are those?
Different loopholes, for example, something known as broad-based categorical eligibility that has allowed states to overlook asset tests, for example, and thereby increase the rolls, make it expand eligibility to a broader pool of people.
What do you mean by overlook asset tests?
So, for example, individuals that are applying for food stamps are states are required to look at what type of assets they have, money in the bank, for example.
I see.
And this policy has allowed states to, in many cases, overlook that.
And what happens from your perspective, what happens when you require people to work to receive food stamps, at least those without kids?
Well, what we've seen in the past with a work requirement, so, for example, back in 1996 when welfare reform was put into place with the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, we saw welfare rolls decrease significantly. We also saw employment rates among low-income individuals increase and child poverty decline. Now, certainly that was a different economic time. However, those changes can partly be attributed to the welfare reform. So I think when we, you know, when we're requiring work, we see individuals move towards self-sufficiency, which really should be the goal of welfare.
And James Siliak, what does your research show on that? Can you separate sort of the changes in the economy from the changes in the requirements?
Yeah, you can, and I have, in fact. So my, you know, estimates show that from 2000 through 2011, which is the last year data I had, about 50% of the increase was due to the weak economy, and about 28% was due to this expanded policies, you know, both broad-based categorical eligibility and a couple other changes, the vehicle asset test, that did allow individuals to join the rolls. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the policy changes have mattered. But it's important to keep in mind why those policy changes came about, and that is prior to the 96 welfare reform, about 70% of those individuals who are eligible for the food stamp program actually signed up to receive benefits. And that fell to about 50% by 2000. So one in two people who were eligible failed to sign up for the benefits. And so policymakers in Washington were somewhat alarmed at this kind of change, turn of events in terms of what we call the take-up rate. And so that kind of sowed the seeds for reforms, which include the introduction of the broad-based categorical eligibility, changes to the vehicle asset test, introducing things like call centers, allowing children of legal immigrants and legal immigrants in general to become re-eligible for the food stamp program, and so on and so forth. So there is a number of policies that the USDA allowed states to experiment with to try to expand outreach and so
more people.
That's right, and it succeeded, and so now the take-up rate today is back up just over 70%, which is the level it was before the 96 welfare reform.
That's 70% of people who are eligible that are actually using them.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right, and so the importantly, while they have expanded the access, that each year they do a random quality control survey of food stamp recipients, and they construct what's called an error rate, which is the percentage of benefits that are either overissued or underissued. And so state by state, they construct these error rates. And nationally, that rate is just below 4%, which is the lowest it's ever been in the program's history. So while they are expanding access, it seems to be running fairly efficiently.
You're listening to Casey Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're talking about the 20,000 people cut from the SNAP program in Kansas and potential cuts to the program elsewhere. Have you or anyone you know relied on the SNAP program or food stamps? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KC Currents. We're going to take a couple phone calls in a minute, but first I want to ask Ellen Feldhausen, who's here from Harvesters. I wonder about here locally. What did you see in terms of hunger and food stamp usage when the recession hit in 2009, late 2000s?
Well, Harvesters is the regional Feeding America food bank. We serve 26 counties, including the Kansas City metropolitan area. And we are, through our network of 620 nonprofit agencies, feeding more people than we've ever fed in our 35-year history. Last year, our last fiscal year, which ended in June, we distributed 44.7 million pounds of food. And since FY 2008, our distributions have increased 73% as a result of the recession and as the result of many working people needing food. 40% of the households that we serve have at least one person in them working. We know anecdotally many of those households have people holding two or more jobs to try to make ends meet. So we know that we're serving a lot of low-income working families, as well as almost half of the people we serve are children and seniors.
And do you know if some of the people you serve also receive food stamps but still need that extra help?
About 50% of the people we serve receive food stamps.
Hmm. I want to take a caller here here in KCK, Michelle. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
What's your comment or question?
My comment and concern is for the homeless people of Kansas. Those folks who are homeless face additional barriers to finding a job, and training programs aren't free. So I expect that a lot of those folks will lose their eligibility for the SNAP program because they can't find a part-time job or afford the training. And this is very concerning for me because homeless folks face enough challenges as it is and would obviously prefer not to starve.
And Rachel Sheffield of the Heritage Foundation, what are your thoughts about homeless people and them, their ability to enter the job market?
Yeah, well, I guess just speaking to specifically to the homeless population, I can't speak specifically to that population, but what I would say is that when we look at food stamps and when we're talking about work requirements, you know, I think it's important that, you know, to make the point that, yes, we want this program to work so that those who do need assistance are able to get it, but we also want it to work in a way that it's promoting self-sufficiency for the individual, you know, whether that is work or doing job training or doing job search. And just, you know, as far as the cost of job training, I mean, states are the ones providing the job training, so I don't think it's so much a matter of the individual not being able to afford it. You know, certainly we know the homeless population does face significant barriers, but ultimately this program should aim to promote self-sufficiency while helping those in need.
And Ellen, I don't know if you have a sense locally here what's available in terms of job training, but either you or James Ziliak, I wonder if you can come and talk about what is available for people in terms of job training.
I can't speak to what the government job training programs are, but they're something that I've just learned in the last couple of weeks. We provide food to nonprofit agencies. Many of these nonprofit agencies provide other services, including helping people prepare to go out and interview for a job, providing them with, you don't go from homeless to a job in one swift step. Sometimes it requires help to get there. And what I've learned from some of our nonprofit partners is many of them are cutting back on these other services in order to feed people. And so some of that support from the nonprofit community is not going to be there because so many of the agencies are simply focusing on providing food to people.
Jim Ziliak, what is that relationship between unemployment? I mean, Kansas, that is instituting these new requirements, does have a very low unemployment rate nationally, but those are kind of known to be low-wage jobs. Kansas tends to be known as a low-wage state. So what is the relationship between employment and food stamp usage?
Well, in general, the trend has been upward. In fact, an increasing share of the caseload nationwide is full-year, full-time workers, and also full-year, part-time workers. And so what you're seeing actually, you know, looking at over the last three decades is this upward trend of the caseload that is increasingly more likely to be employed. Another thing, if you look at the data, they're also increasingly more likely to be educated with some college, okay, so to be high school graduates and have some post-secondary education, and increasingly living in households that have incomes, you know, just above the federal poverty line. And so, in effect, the SNAP program has kind of evolved into a work support for educated, near-poor working households. Now, it still is serving a population that is not expected to work. You know, roughly two-thirds of the food stamp caseload are children or disabled or seniors. And so we don't, at this point in time, have an expectation of work amongst those populations. Amongst the adults who are of working age population and not disabled, the likelihood of their actually being a part of the labor force has increased over time. And one of the challenges that's facing workers in general, especially low-skilled workers, is the shortage of full-time work and the rise in part-time work. So, the issue that confronts policy is that, you know, somebody might be able to consistently hold a job that's of 15 or so hours a week because that's what they get, and yet technically they wouldn't be eligible for the food stamp benefit under that rule because they don't meet that 20-hour threshold. And so, you know, firms are more inclined in recent years, and most job creation since the Great Recession has been in the form of part-time work. And so it's difficult for individuals to actually find the full-time jobs, especially those with fewer skills.
I want to bring in Aaron from Topeka. If you want to join the conversation, call 816-235-2888. That's our number. But hi, Aaron.
My comment is about those who have emotional difficulties like social anxiety disorder who are unable to work extended hours and they're not diagnosed or on Social Security disability, that food stamp system is basically their only lifeline, and if that's taken away, that'll create a massive hardship for those who are undiagnosed mentally ill.
Jim Ziliak, do you have a sense of how many people that fall into that category might be undiagnosed but having trouble seeking work because of an undiagnosed mental illness will then have a hard time getting a job and be cut off?
Well, I don't have hard numbers on that. To give you some sense of potential for that population, roughly about 50 to 60% of people who apply for disability insurance are denied. And then of those who appeal that decision, roughly about half end up ultimately receiving the disability. So at least, you know, roughly around a third of people who actually apply for disability are denied. And so amongst that population, they may actually face a barrier or perhaps multiple barriers to employment, and yet they're unable to demonstrate a significant enough need to qualify for disability insurance. And so technically they could be negatively affected by this policy.
Now, we have a caller in on the plaza. Hi, Al.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a great discussion. I was thinking it was a little on the bureaucratic side, but I just wanted to ask about the human element here a little bit. I think we're getting in that direction. One is I heard recently that the highest percentage level of poverty in the region is actually Johnson County. Now, I know that contradicts the myth of Johnson County, and I was wondering if anybody on the panel
has
any statistics about that.
And I think what I have read recently is that the level of poverty is really growing in Johnson County and maybe the greatest growth, but I don't have that data. But you were wondering how you actually qualify for food stamps, too?
Now, that was, the other question was, during the downturn in the economy a few years ago, 4 years ago, whatever it was, I swear, in 20 million years, I never would have thought I would even consider applying for food stamps. But I did, and it was a very interesting experience because I was in my 60s, unemployable at the moment, and I had savings, but the practical daily living issues were very, very scary at the time. So I applied, and of course I didn't qualify. I had money in the bank, and I had other sources of income that were become visible when you applied for food stamps. So I didn't qualify, but here I was in a very strange kind of catch-22 situation. And I just don't know that we understand what it is when people really have a moment of need. And with this idea of providing food to people is a very important thing. If our underclasses are deprived of any more opportunities for growth, we're going to have serious social issues in our culture. And we have to know that everyone is fed. And I'm just wondering, how does the food stamp program plan to adjust to the new economy?
Right, Al, you know, we're going to have to bring this to a close because we're bringing this segment to a close, but I really appreciate your comment here and you're sharing your experiences. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us here, too. Ellen Feldhausen of Harvesters, the Community Food Network in Kansas City, thanks so much. James Ziliak, economics professor at the University of Kentucky, thank you. And Rachel Sheffield, policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation, thank you for your time. Coming up after the break, we ask, what is that? And take a closer look at an unusual-looking house tucked among the split levels and ranches in Casey's Red Bridge neighborhood. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Do you ever see something that catches your eye while you're walking or driving around town? Something that makes you turn your head in wonder as you pass by? Casey Currents explores these curiosities in an occasional series we call What Is That? Susan Wilson asked this very question each time she drove past this sprawling, elaborately decorated property in South Kansas City's Red Bridge neighborhood. Finally, she just had to stop and meet the owner, who takes home and garden to a whole new level.
Between all of these typical suburban houses and lawns in Red Bridge, you can't help but notice a cream-colored house with black shutters sitting on a quadruple lot. Swans and ducks are swimming on a large pond. Is this an animal sanctuary? But then there are the flower gardens, sculpture displays, and unusual swings. And if I pass by during the holidays, the corner is ablaze in twinkling lights and elaborate decorations. When I finally stop by, I find owner Pamela Bowen doing what she loves, hanging out with her animals. Black and white speckled hens with brilliant red combs scurry by her. A white swan walks authoritatively up to Pam and me, as if to see what is going on.
That's Mr. Swan.
Hi, Mr. Swan.
He's grand. He's just great. He rules the roost around here. And he's really tame as long as you don't touch him. He just doesn't want to be touched. And here comes the old man goose. He's the oldest goose. He can hardly make it.
Pam is a high school teacher and world traveler. She's athletically built, with salt and pepper hair that falls just below her chin. And she was born in this house. It's hard to imagine now, but farmland and fields covered this area in the late 40s. The house was built in 1947 by Pam's father, a pharmacist and machinist. Her parents were married there, and she has fond memories of riding in a cart behind her father's lawnmower.
I can remember the cows coming across the street. And Warner Road was a one-lane country street. And there were only about a few cars a day that went down it in the late 40s and early 50s.
Pam leads me to a pond down a leaf-strewn path. A large plume of water is shooting up from the center of the greenish pool. My eye is immediately drawn to a curvaceous wrought iron bridge with a red and white rowboat named Anna docked underneath.
That was my mother's name, so it's Anna the rowboat's named after her.
The bridge is one of many structures Pam has built herself. She learned carpentry, concrete, and other construction skills from her uncles. Her love of animals compels her to create homes that are customized for each animal species, like miniature horse Pepper, who has a small stable. But the animals can't just have any house. Pam painstakingly creates unique designs for our animal abodes.
Everybody has their own house. And because I have a split level down here. And one side is where the chickens live. And another side is where another set of chickens live. Then I have my gingerbread house that I made off of. Every wall is crooked on it. And the roof and all four walls are crooked. And it took me about 3 months to make it, and it was taken off of a birdhouse, but it looks like Cinderella's house.
We walk past grapevines heavy with fruit and a largish brown house with mint green scallop trim. Pam's goat Nanny perched contentedly on this roof for years, until she was too old to climb. Now a younger goat has taken over the roof. Pam's uncle helped her outfit the house with a concrete roof, so the goats wouldn't fall through.
Well, they like to live on mountaintops and on edges. They like up off of things.
I see.
And, the roof is curved so it conforms to the goat. When it lays down, it's so comfortable up there for him because it's curved on top.
Pam leads me to a whole different world in the back of the house where there are beautiful gardens, fountains, and life-size sculptures of women. But it's the front of the house that grabs neighborhood attention. Pam became passionate about decking out her property for the holidays after her family won a Christmas lighting contest years ago. Now she's always on the lookout for unique decorations for Easter, Halloween, and Christmas holidays.
Like, I have 800 red lights on the bridge for the Red Bridge. This is the Red Bridge area and the Red Bridge, the real Red Bridge down on Red Bridge Road. And then a gazebo has 400 lights. I do that the next weekend. And then I try to bring all the reindeer up. And then right after Thanksgiving, I spend about 4 days putting everything out.
This month, Pam is getting ready to put up Halloween decorations. And one of her favorites is a witch that flies into a tree. Pam started really focusing on improving the property after college. She was influenced by her mother's love of puttering in the yard. And she says her property is no different from anyone else's.
And it really is not any different than anybody else's. But every year we'd receive a couple cards in the mail thanking us for just making people's lives happy. One time we received a card from a divorced lady, and she said every day when she goes home from work, she goes by our house, and it just makes her a little happier after her divorce.
No doubt some not-so-nice people have noticed the house, too. Once, a goat was stolen for a fraternity party. Political campaign signs were unceremoniously dumped in Pam's pond by supporters of the opposing candidate. And sometimes, people just drop off animals at Pam's house.
Somebody dumped a rabbit off on us. Just threw the poor rabbit over the fence, and I didn't see it, and my cousin found it, and so now I'm trying to make him, I've never had a rabbit before in my life, and I'm trying to make him a cute little house, so he has an area. I poured some concrete, and he just thinks that's great to stretch out on the concrete.
Not everybody can go to the length Pam Bowen goes to take care of her animals and beautify her landscape. But she has some advice for fellow homeowners.
I just think everybody needs to take care of their property and enjoy their property and try to make it shine as much as possible. I guess make people's lives happy.
For KC Currents, I'm Susan Wilson in South Kansas City.
See photos of Pam Bowen's animals and animal houses on our website at kcur.org. And if you have a place you'd like us to investigate for our What Is That series, email us at kcurrents@kcur.org. To end today's show, we're going to stop by a couple of recent cultural events in the Crossroads. The Kansas City Ballet is putting its finishing touches on a world premiere. But first, a local beauty pageant enters its 32nd year. Miss Gay Kansas City is one of the oldest female impersonation pageants in the country. This year's competition was held last Saturday evening at Hamburger Mary's in the Crossroads. KC Currents' Esther Honig has this audio postcard.
I was Miss Gay Missouri 2008. My name is Sparkle Iman, and my role is the head judge in this afternoon. We have two contestants tonight fighting for the title of Miss Kansas City, and what's going to happen is tonight they're going to compete in evening gown and on-stage question, and then they're also going to do their long talent, which is 7 minutes, can be up to 7 minutes long.
Welcome to the stage, contestant number one, Miss Kyle Breed. Please welcome to the stage, contestant number two, Miss Honey Banks.
We live our life as men on a day-to-day basis, and then we choose to do the art of female impersonation at night to portray what we want to portray.
And what are some of the requirements for being a participant in this event?
Well, you have to be a guy, and then not only that, you know, you have to be above the age of 21, and then that's basically it. Anybody can enter as long as they know what they're doing. We're looking at somebody who has the quality and the pizzazz, someone who can be professional at all times, as well as be entertaining. We're looking for the overall figure.
My name's Heidi Banks. I feel that I deserve to be Miss Gay Kansas City because I have all the attributes that it really takes. I have drive, I have tenacity, and I'm passionate. I know that there's no one who wants to succeed in this more than I do. I want this really badly, and I'm going to fight for it.
What is your talent for tonight?
I will be singing. I'm a live singer, so I'll be singing tonight. We sing A Wrecking Ball by Miley Cyrus.
girls. There will all be one winner. Our first runner-up this evening is Miss Heidi Banks. Oh, my God. That is my bad. Heidi Banks is actually our winner. Our first runner-up is Miss Tyler Breeze.
These past 2 days, I've been competing for the title Miss Gay Kansas City America. And after solo talent, male interview, evening gown, onstage question, and talent, I am the winner of Miss Gay Kansas City. And it feels really great.
Heidi Banks has begun her reign as Miss Gay Kansas City and goes on to compete this spring for the title of Miss Gay Missouri. If she wins there, she'll go on to compete in the national pageant for Miss Gay America. And now to another event. Across the crossroads, at the Todd Bollinger Center for Dance and Creativity, the Kansas City Ballet is rehearsing a world premiere. The new artistic director, Devin Carney, is slipping a brand new production into the ballet's season opener next weekend. Opus 1 provides a hint of the vision he has for the company. KCUR's Julie Deniche caught up with Carney during a recent rehearsal and brought back this audio postcard.
This is my first season as artistic director for Kansas City Ballet, which of course I'm absolutely thrilled about. The first production of the year is pretty much already been put together in terms of its repertoire that would be performed. I saw a need for one more thing on the program, so I added to the program a piece called Opus 1. The title is specifically because it's the first work I'm having the chance to do for Kansas City Ballet, and I feel I need to say, here it is. This is my first time. I'm excited about the work. It's Schubert's Symphony No. 9, The Great, it's called, the nickname. And it's a great work musically on its own. It's, of course, one of the most well-known and full symphonies that Schubert ever did in terms of orchestral work. Your eyes just open up wide when you hear this music. It's so big. And I wanted something that big because I'm having all of our company dancers on stage in classical tutus, the men in tunics. It's a very classically based work. Bringing Opus 1 as a concluding piece on the program is just making a statement about where we're headed as a company, that we're going to continue to work on the great neoclassical works, that we're going to continue to pursue the cutting edge emerging choreographers of tomorrow, today. And on top of that, we're going to expand our horizons in terms of our classical repertoire. And, you know, that could include in the future large-scale classical works that have never been done by Kansas City Ballet, which I'm very excited to pursue in the near future. And five, six, and eight, one, two, and three, and up, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, one, four.
Devin Carney's Opus 1 premieres October 11th at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. For more information and to watch a video, check our website at kcur.org. That's it for Casey Kearns today. Our live broadcast will be every Thursday morning from now on. If you missed part of the show, or you want to hear it again, or subscribe to the podcast, check out our page at kcur.org. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents. Central Standard returns tomorrow with the Food Critics and a look at the food offerings in Lawrence. Up next on Up to Date, the ethics professors ask about ethical issues surrounding the government shutdown. Today's Casey Currents was produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Suzanne Hogan, Alex Smith, and Susan Wilson. Our interns are Esther Honig, Monica Sandretsky, Ross Steinmetz, and Sydney Llewellyn. Theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and this is KCUR.